Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
T-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to a Friday the 13th way to kick off 2012. My name is Garnet Lee. Thanks for joining us on Weekend Confirmed. No Jeff Cannata here today. He is prepping for his first production of 2012, which will be running here in Los Angeles in the coming month, I believe. Dave, when does that kick off? Is that February that he starts? All right. So that production kicks off in February, and we are adjusting our schedule so that he can join us in future episodes, including one that'll be coming up with Mr. David Jaffe right before Twisted Metal comes out. But this week, we have two very special guests for you. Well, let me introduce them here in just a moment after I say that at the other end of the table is also Mr. Jeff Mattis from Shack News.
Yeah, how's it going, everybody? We do have a Jeff here, in fact.
It's yes.
Not Mr. Cannata.
We do have a Jeff.
So, hi.
And you're here because Zav can't be here because his refrigerator blew up and his kitchen is full of water.
Yeah, he's probably ankle deep in refuse right now.
So, you know, there you go. It's already Friday the 13th. So joining us, though, from Big Huge Studios are two very well-known guys. One of them is the combat designer for Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning.
Right.
Try to say that five times real fast. That would be Joe Q.
Hi, how you doing?
Who's also had a long career stemming all the way back to QAing on Blood Omen 2 many, true. Many moons ago.
Yeah.
Ken loves that I dropped that out there.
Blood Omen 2, Soul Reaver 2, original Soul Reaver. Yeah.
It's so all around awesome. The Crystal D world.
Yeah. So Legacy of Kain is great.
He knows his way around virtually swinging a sword, which we're going to talk about a little bit later on. And then we also have the very, very legendary game designer Ken Ralston here.
Internationally celebrated game designer. Yeah, everybody out there can practice that together. Internationally celebrated game designer. Thank you very much.
Who earned his chops all the way back when we were using pencils and papers to play role-playing games and throwing dice. Oh. So there will be a virtual dice simulator inside Reckoning someplace. You'll just have to find it. It's in there. The little elves doing their thing behind the scenes.
Yeah, you have to use the Konami code, though.
Oh, you have to use the... Well, now you've given it away. Oh. Joe, you shouldn't give it away right off the bat.
Enter it backwards, maybe?
Yeah, that? Something. It'll be a secret. You'll have to figure it out. So, here's what we got going on today. We're going to talk about some of... obviously, with these guys here in the game they have, we want to re-engage on the role-playing game topics that came up last week. You guys took me to task for my complaints with Skyrim. Who better to discuss these subjects than two guys that are, you know, knee deep in the end of the process of readying their latest game? And of course, Ken has a huge background. If you are not already familiar with him, he was lead design on Morrowind and Oblivion. So he might stand up and behead me as I take out any frustrations on his former charges.
Yeah, Ken, just let me know if you need the sword.
I'm going to rip him apart with my lungs and hands.
Okay, the good thing is we're just starting out, so he only has a rusty longsword right now, and I think that I'm perfectly well adept to like fend that off.
You don't even have leather yet, is what I'm saying. You're going down.
All I'm going to say is my Thaco is pretty good.
You're a good runner.
Yeah, I'm a good runner. Yeah. Very good runner.
High movement rate.
Nimble host.
So we've got that. The IGF finalists were announced this week. We've got Jeff here, so we definitely want to give some love to the indies that are out there. There's a little bit of CES bragging from Microsoft I thought we'd talk about, but all in all, I think there's never been more obvious why there's not a whole lot of reason to go to CES anymore. You know, I did it for 7 years, and you know, the only thing I miss anymore is seeing the friends and stuff, and there's plenty of great chances to do that. So, you know, enjoy your world tech, people, and games are I think really have grown out of that shadow. That's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, there are a lot of big gaming shows that are great. We don't need that many.
No, not at all. So that's about it, folks, and that's what the big show is going to look like. So I'm going to dive right in with sort of an intro to this whole RPG thing, with a big piece of news that hit on Tuesday, which was Bethesda tossing Interplay a couple million dollars as part of the settlement that finally, once and for all, lays this whole Fallout MMO Interplay production to rest. Who knows whether or not that was, you know, anything other than smoke and mirrors. And it was definitely a Hail Mary attempt by Interplay to try and salvage the company, which, you know, hey, Interplay had a great legacy and nothing against that. Obviously, who wouldn't want to try and stay in business for as long as they could? And obviously, they built up the Fallout world. But that begs the question now that this is now the Fallout world has been consolidated under Bethesda's mantle. Who have not built an MMO, but have been the subjects of much speculation because they have these worlds to build in. Do we want, or does it even matter, that there would be the opportunity to make now a Fallout MMO from Bethesda, or for that matter, an Elder Scrolls MMO? And this is a hotly debated subject. A bunch of you guys there on Shack News have been into it. Wolf Slice immediately said, who wants a Fallout MMO anyway? Fallout and Elder Scrolls are the last good single-player RPGs. And I thought that that's a good place to introduce things because I don't understand why having the last great RPG would rule out having a good MMO. So I don't know. What do you think? Jeff, do you want a Fallout MMO?
My gut reaction is, of course I do. I love Fallout. But then I think about it for a minute, and those experiences for me were very solitary experiences.
Yeah.
You are a lone wolf and you're, you know, exploring a wasteland. I think, you know, you populate a wasteland with hundreds of people in a server and you're going to kind of, I don't know how you maintain that feel of isolation and post-apocalyptic.
So you're in line with Mecha Tofu Pirate, who said that Fallout doesn't even make sense as an MMO.
Oh yeah, I guess I am.
The world is supposed to be mostly empty. That doesn't work when you have tons of people running around looking for raid groups. I don't know. I think that there must be some way to balance that out. You guys, that's what the creative team does, right?
For me, as a creative genius, it strikes me as a very great opportunity to do a role-playing game that isn't stuck with dragons and things like that. And, you know, the other alternative is ray guns. And ray guns is actually not as fertile and useful because the tropes are not as widely shared. Only Dungeons & Dragons, which people started out with D&D and all that stuff, and around the table with orcs, everybody understands that language, so you begin able to play in that setting. Now, there is no real-world setting that has, with the exception of Fallout, that has many of the same things that are familiar to the rest of us. So if I were looking for a place where I was going to do a role-playing game, I'd love to do it in a post-apocalyptic world like Fallout, but I'd also like a chance to be social in that end times situation. That is, I could wear the stuff that I wear. I could express myself in the way that I'm in. It's like Call of Cthulhu as a role-playing game is one of those rare games that you could play in the modern world. And I think that's a wonderful opportunity for role-playing instead of using dice or that other stuff. It'd be a great, for me, place to try to wander away from the level advancement treadmill as the currency of whether a game is great. And instead it would go to, who am I? What do I care about? What do I want to do? I'm not a power gamer now. I just want to be me in this terrible place. Now, by the way, I don't know if that's commercial, but that's exciting to me as an opportunity.
And whether or not it sets up that loop that you were talking about.
Yeah, it's because I believe, having played live-action role-playing games and around the tabletop, you know, combat is not good. It's slow-paced. You know, there's a lot of rules lawyer issue. It's pace compared to the dialogue and then the payoff, dramatic payoff to dialogue. Like, you and I can hold forth in mono digital fervent articulation and I can wag my finger at you and I can crush your soul. And it's drama. And I don't have to have any rules or any crap like that. Whereas for combat on the table, oh, man, it just goes, oh, I'm moving 12 centimeters in this direction and I'm equipping my –
But when we have a good game master – now we're getting into Jeff should be here. Jeff Cannata is so frustrated. We have a good game master. Well, the good game master is giving us.
But he doesn't bother to use the rules, which is the same thing as being a director. He's just dropping that game crap out, and he's choreographing role playing. So what I'm going to say, as an internationally celebrated game designer from before the earth cooled in role playing games, there are four kinds of role players. One of them is the war gamer. One of them is the power gamer. We love both of those people. There's a narrative gamer, too, who actually wants to tell great stories. He can do without most of that other claptrap from old war games. And the role-playing gamer is the one farthest away from all that other stuff to have that experience where the compulsion loop is, I won in that moral high ground argument, or I won in that emotional argument, or I have made you my friends, you people who are my enemies across the street. First thing I always loved to do in a 10 by 10 room that had cloud giants in it is I wanted to go in and make friends with a cloud giant. Because it was cool and because it made the games master's head explode. So that's kind of a perverse reason. But at the same time, it's because I knew that talking to the cloud giant would be cooler and more unlike anything I'd ever done before than fighting it out on the table. So, again, looking for novelty, mm-hmm. looking for new experiences for you guys who are, by the way, tragically, you know, deprived in that sense. You haven't played LARPs or whatever it is. But I know LARPs, and I gave up tabletop role-playing because talking to people and working things out is so much more thoroughly entertaining, and being hosed by other players is so dramatic. So much better than being killed and doing a reload.
I used to be heavily into the tabletop RPGs, and I think one of the last ones I played were ones that were developed by White Wolf, because they were very much like you're talking about. They're very story-driven. They're not about – I mean, yeah, you can have combat in them and whatever, but
Ken's
it's not
nodding
about
his approval,
that at all.
By the way, folks.
Pointing at him as though he were wise.
So like Vampire and Werewolf and stuff like that. I mean, those are all – you know, allow you to do what you're talking about, the fun part of role playing, which is gets away from all the dice rolling and the tables and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
There really is an important role of how well we can identify with whatever we're playing with, right? Because I'm thinking, while you were talking initially about this, I was thinking of back in the day when Richard Garriott was trying to pull together Tabula Rasa, mm-hmm. and which originally was, you know, it was in his wheelhouse with the fantasy stuff. And I always felt like when we were talking to him, when it was a fantasy game, that he was, you know, had that sparkle in the eye and the glow was going and you just felt like things were churning. And then, you know, it went away for a little while and came back with the ray guns. And it was more than just that the ray guns lacked, you know, you just don't know how to identify with it, right? It's maybe it's because tech is not as fun or as connective as having a staff and casting a fireball.
It doesn't tap into Campbell-level underlying Jungian archetypes, you know, or you could go on forever, but essentially it's not as
okay, you're going to have to give me a little more than that because
shit.
I lost you.
Oh, okay. Jungian archetypes, it's the idea that every hero has the same nature because he has the same kind of a problem. He has to leave the community to go out to find something that the community needs. He comes back as a hero, but he comes back wiser, and he always ends up coming back to home, and he's changed, and the world has changed.
I mean, pulling back to the Elric novels now.
Yeah. That's all that is, by the way, we file serial numbers off all literature, and we just jam it into the game and say that's sensitive art. Well, those things are very compelling emotionally, and I'll take an example. True Blood, I hope that's the name of the television show, the vampire, and
it's one of them. Yes,
one of them. And then there's okay, what's the really cool science fiction thing by Joss Whedon?
Fringe?
Work with
Dollhouse?
Me. No. It's a space.
Serenity?
Serenity, yeah. And it's Firefly.
Firefly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are things where the deliciousness of those games are the characters, and you would need some way to have conflicts occasionally, but to play them and to play those roles, particularly, I think, actually True Blood, because there's more of the Jungian archetypes, the big, tall Viking, and then the guy who goes away because he's weary of life. These are more compelling emotional stories for me to put on than can I use my axe right now. By the way, I like using my axe. It's really, really good in another context, but I'm saying, you know, Fallout, why
same,
not?
Same place that that many critics ascribe to why Walking Dead is so successful for AMC. It's not about fighting the zombies. It's not about pulling out a shotgun and taking out the zombie
absolutely
who's coming at you.
True,
it's about the interaction between the survivors. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
So that makes all sense to me. So they're kind of moving on from there. The combat, though, and we got Joe here. I got to let Joe turn loose a little bit on
hey,
combat
that's me.
Some. Because one of my chief complaints and about Skyrim, which we've been talking about a considerable amount over the last few weeks, is that relative to the degree of immersion that I have in my character, in the environment, in the world, that when it comes time to take on enemies, I find myself completely yanked, you know, as if really pulled right back out of the world because the combat doesn't live up to that that level of immersion. I'm just wailing away with a sword or backing off and firing a few arrows, and I can't even decide whether or not I want to be watching my character animation in third person or in first person. And when I make a decision between the two, it's as much about managing camera and situation as anything else.
It disconnects you from the narrative.
So I have to say that at least as a player of games, I feel like I need that combat to really work in the context of a role-playing game. And I love your four archetypes because I don't know where I fall. I have to have story. I have to have, I adore story. I play role-playing games because I choose them as my entertainment. They, you know, I will choose them over a movie. I'll choose them over a book because I love being involved in the story and playing along with the character. But I typically find myself more drawn to what we consider the Japanese style role-playing game because of the desire, because yes, so Ken,
you're
so,
a role player and a storyteller a lot more. They're richer in their archetypes. They probably, you have some more strong emotional attachment to, and those are better games about the connections with characters. Because
I'm a dyed in the wool romantic. I mean, that's simple.
Duh. And then, by the way, yes, there Japanese role playing games have a lot of that that we don't try that hard for that in American games, with the exception, by the way, BioWare does a pretty amazing job in many ways.
Good point.
But I would have to say, again, still not the same level of focus as the JRPGs.
But in addition to that, one of the other elements I've sort of pulled out of that is that I love a good combat system. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a turn-based combat system, but I love a good combat system because then I feel like all of this work that I've done building up my character and making them, you know, good at, you know, wielding two daggers or good at casting fireball spells now translates into here's why I was able to use that effectively in the field of battle. Joe, are you really emphasis on designing, like when you come into looking at this stuff, how do you approach it?
Well, first off, I really look to the Japanese action games because I think it's really hard to top action games outside of Japan. I think recently we can look at God of War as being a really good example of a strong action game sort of the Western market. But I really look at sort of what are they doing there? And then it's sort of like, how am I going to express myself in combat as a player? And how am I going to allow all these people who are building these characters that are going all over the place as far as whether they're lawful good or whatever it is, to express themselves in combat and role play in combat. And so I have to give them a lot of choice within that and that comes out in movement, that comes out in the how close they want to get to enemies, whether they want to just tank attacks and let them hit them, or whether they want to block attacks or dodge and never be attacked. And I put out this questionnaire to the whole studio back when we started, and I just wanted to see how people saw themselves as a fighter. And I got some answers back from like guys like Kurt Schilling who said, if I use a health potion, it was sort of the answer. His answer was, he wrote this in. He said, I've failed. I want to go reload a save.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And we have players like that. And and we have to.
Ken adores that. You don't want to use health potion.
No, I happen to have a touch of that. I'm not quite that bad about it.
Okay.
But yes, absolutely. If I get mud on my tights, I've failed. Because I kind of am a role playing. You wouldn't like it if you got a slice in your arm, even though that only represents.
But it's not really me. It's an extension in a fantasy world.
No, that's
I want a fight that challenges
immersed.
Me.
You're not. Oh, by the way, I didn't say you shouldn't want that thing, but challenging to me is not failing. You know?
Oh, it's interesting. See, I want to be wearing those. I want to be, you know, wearing those leather pauldrons, and at the end of the fight, look down and see where it got
gladiator.
Sliced all the way through,
yeah.
And I've got blood coming off my shoulder. Yeah. But damn it, I won that fight.
You want to see the movie Gladiator? You want to be in that movie?
I'm with you. I want to be the same way. And so I will say, Kurt was the minority, definitely, but it spoke to me in saying that I want to support all of these play styles and make them feel like they work.
So here's where I got taken to task, and I thought that these commenters did a pretty good job of lining out the different points of this discussion, which was open world versus story and good combat and how much it all plays into it. Elvin Stein said that my point of view, Garnet, that is, was maddening, and that I was basically asking for Skyrim to be a completely different game. And that really wasn't what I was getting at, Alan Stein. What the miscommunication came from, so you guys are filled in, was that I feel like playing Skyrim, oftentimes I get a little lost, and I wish that there was some way for there to be a AI director watching over how I was playing the game and orchestrating how much of the open world was unfurled in front of me at any given time. And that being a thing so that there was enough keeping me on the path of being a hero, that I was still being a hero and not being distracted by going and helping find some wheat for a lovely maid to make some bread for her beau, because I'm a hero and I'm going to get pulled away to go do those things because that's the character I'm playing. But at some point in time, it would be nice if the game, without me and fully transparently, because I don't want to know about it, I don't want to interrupt that immersion, but didn't just put all of that in front of me. This, on the other hand, offended Elvenstein, who said that if the game funneled you through the main quest while allowing you a few moments to do side quests, then what is the point of the game being so massive? My favorite thing about Skyrim is that there are tons of interesting things to do and that I can choose to do them in any order. In any game, there's a huge distinction made between main missions and side quests. In Skyrim, many of the side quests are as expertly crafted as the main missions, almost hard to distinguish between in terms of quality. In other games, I do a few side quests and eventually find myself being driven back to the main quest out of boredom. The fact of this never occurred while I was playing Skyrim is something that I consider a huge accomplishment. Okay, I get that. On the other hand, Lundash agreed with me and said that the game is constantly trying to lead you off in different directions, and that if you try to maximize your game experience, which, you know, that's a common player trait, like, I want to get the most out of my $60 I put into this thing,
right,
then you get pulled all over the place, and you lose your sense of urgency. And then we had a very interesting side point by Hockey Johnson, who says, I'm playing and enjoying Skyrim, so take this from a place of love, but the main missions in the game are not very good. They're flat, talky, and repetitive. There is exactly one puzzle type in the whole game, and it's not that great a puzzle to begin with. The side quests are better because their small scope means that the inherent weaknesses of the system Bethesda created doesn't show through as much. There's probably a good argument for Skyrim not having a main story at all, and that should just exist in a perpetual Animal Crossing state. No end game, no dramatic sweep that doesn't fit the character you built. Just talk to people and get stuff and furnish your house for forever.
That's actually how I end up playing Skyrim. I go into it for the story, and because of how big it is and how much great side content there is, you get to a point where if you haven't visited the main storyline in, say, 10 hours or 12 hours or 15 hours, you're like, what am I doing next? You know, but you don't even care because you're, you know, questing for the Dark Brotherhood, or you're, you know, going off doing stuff for the Thieves Guild. I think really how much that bothers you sort of depends on what type of a gamer you are or what type of experience you're looking for. Like, if you want that, if you want ultimately to be taken through a really compelling story, you'll get that in bite-sized chunks in Skyrim. But I think because of the scope of the game, you know, it's hard to be tethered to that main plot line all the way through because there's so much extra stuff to distract you.
I think that there has to be some way to better create a directed experience, if you will. Directed meaning like a director, without making it become I'm walking down a hallway, I can only go down this hallway, and the next crate will be in front of me because someone put that crate in front of me to get to it. I get that that's not all that exciting.
It just made me think. The problems that you're talking about when you compare, say, Skyrim to The Witcher 2, The Witcher 2 is much more focused in that regard. so you don't have as many moments where you're like, what the heck am I supposed to be doing? It's all in aid to what you're doing, what your next main objective is. But it's open enough that you can go around and do little side stuff, but it is more focused.
I'd say Fable's in the same category too. I felt like I had no problem completing Fable, the side quests eventually, I could tell they were side quests, and so I just completed the game.
And yet they ultimately threw in the towel as far as trying to handle the balance issue and just said, well, you know, screw it. We're just going to throw a little golden trail on the ground in front of you, and you can just follow it and figure out. That's not that good a solution, really. You know, that makes me think of the blue chevrons on the ground in Perfect Dark.
At the same time, I'm playing Dungeon Siege 3 right now, and I need the golden trail to tell me where to go because their quest log is so horrendous.
It is pretty bad.
You do need something to tell you where the next place is to go, I think. Otherwise, I'm reading game facts all day.
And can't we do that inside the game engine, though?
But is that poor level design if you need, like, if the game isn't good at communicating to you where you need to go next, even if it's not through, I mean, I agree, the trail of glowing breadcrumbs is the most obvious. Yeah, it's, I mean, and it breaks the immersion and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you need something to
I feel you're missing one possible point, is that there need to be different kinds of interfaces and different kinds of experience for different people. And I am so grateful for all these different new experiments with interfaces. I think we learned a lot from a glowing trail. Whether I would use it in an individual game would depend very much on my purpose and my audience. And I would say, for example, that we're very different in Reckoning than in Skyrim. Skyrim should deliberately seduce and amaze on the point of misdirection and lack of clarity and ambiguity, because it's a morally ambiguous world.
Right.
And as all that stuff, I think, fits the narrative. It fits the theme and the tone and the sense of place. Whereas we think that it isn't an interface thing that you ought to have. It ought to be a narrative thing that made the main quest more compelling. We call it the yellow brick road. It's just a thing where you can always look, and it's partly level design. It's probably flow, characters who are attractive. It's just little glittering nuggets which you are less likely to forget because they're compelling, and they don't force you in any way. But perhaps, again, it'd be interesting to have you play Reckoning and then, say, mid-game, evaluate how you felt about those two ways of communicating the main quest and how they suited your personal rhythms. But at the end of the day, I'd just say, those are your, you know, silly personal, you know, rhythms. And you, although enormously educated and sophisticated in your tastes and, let's say, compelled to express them in strong ways, you are just one of a million different kinds of people. Right. And I want to be able to run you and Jeff and Joe and everybody else in the universe as software in my head, and to be able, as I look at the game, to see where all those little metaphorical glowing trails are going and how they're working. And as Joe will tell you, it's also our user experience testing that, you know, I can make it up in my head. It has to be tested.
Yeah. We were talking last week a lot about Star Wars The Old Republic because obviously we've been playing you guys have been playing a good bit of it. I still have not gotten around to it. And Jeff was on this subject of interface. I thought this was uniquely applicable, talking about how to him the game has sort of degenerated into a WoW-like watching the meters on his screen fill up and clicking the button once they filled up. And someone online on Shaq, I wish I had written this comment down because I thought we wouldn't get to it, but it's really applicable here. It said, you know, Jeff, what you need to do is hit this little trick. It's called Control-Z, and it turns off the entire interface for the game. He said, and learn your character. He said, learn your character, and much as if you were that character, you would know how to execute whatever move it is, know exactly what move it is you want to hit and hit the keys for it, and know how long it takes for that ability to recover. Not because you're watching a meter fill on the screen, but because you've become, you know, sort of one with the idea of, I know, I just cast this. I know how long it takes to recover. It will have recovered by the time I do this and this.
Now, in theory, that's a really neat idea, and I like the principle behind it. But playing that game, you get so many abilities and little things you can do and little hotkeys. I mean, half of them I only have used half a dozen times, and trying to memorize, okay, every level I get another two or three powers or upgrades. I don't know. To me, the act of memorizing how to activate all this stuff without an interface would be even more sort of mind destroying than, you know, just using the
cooldowns themselves are kind of a weird gamey feature that kind of require an interface, because there's not a real world similar thing that we can look at.
It simulates nothing familiar.
Yeah. So if we had something like that, maybe I could have a glowing thing on my arm and start simulating it in game a little bit. But there's probably another way to balance things without a cooldown, and that would sort of get you towards that type of gameplay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah.
I'm going to put a little cooldown meter right here on the show. We'll take a little break. When we come back on the other side of this, we will let these two guys talk about how they've answered these questions about lore and character and combat and open world and keeping you focused in on the yellow brick road when Weekend Confirmed continues. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from ShackNews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Weekend Confirmed in the GameFly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. All right, we are off to a rollicking start and still have a lot more to come later on. We're going to have Jeff talk a little bit about some of the fine indie games up for the grand prize coming up at GDC in the IGF.
Damn right,
yeah. Some good titles up in there. Fez in there again.
Yeah, it'll be the last time Fez is in there, though.
God, maybe.
It will. It's coming out this year. I'll bet you... $5. No, it's really coming out this year, I promise.
Love those guys. Well, coming out in just a few weeks. What is it now? You guys are at 3 weeks?
3 weeks.
3 weeks.
We're not doing math. You can't make us do it.
You can't make you do it. Anyway, that's...
I'm with you guys on that.
That is your game. I'm going to let you guys hold court now. Tell us about Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, and then we're going to tie back to all these questions and ideas that we introduced, which is really, I mean, that was one of the things that was exciting about having you guys on now, is that I've been thinking a lot about this stuff, and here I get an opportunity to talk about two folks who have been obviously doing the same, and how it relates to what you guys have been doing with Reckoning. So I'll let you guys take the floor, talk about Reckoning.
Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning is an open-world RPG, and what we've decided to do is just hype up the combat and make it more spectacular. So we started looking at action games and all sorts of fighting games and those engines, and seeing how we could build an engine that could kind of do both the crunchy, deep RPG systems and also the hardcore action combat that we wanted. And it was a crazy idea to begin with. We weren't even sure if we could do it, but we... went through a prototype phase and came out sort of 6 months out and really strongly believed that we could do it. And then we already had a lot of talent that could create really deep stories and lore and knew how to make the open world RPG. And then we just built the team from the ground up to start doing the action combat. And sort of we went in from there, and I'll let Ken sort of describe the rest.
Why should you be playing another role-playing game? Well, because you're compulsive, and we understand that. But on the other hand, I want you to play a role-playing game in the same way that I played my first role-playing game back when there weren't all these genres, back when I was playing Wizardry. It was just another thing I could buy to play with on my computer. And I want you to do the same thing on your consoles. I don't want you to just think that this is a role-playing game. I want you to think that this is just a fun way to push buttons or to have this experience. And it's got pretty colors, and it has people associated with it who don't suck, you know, like R.A. Salvatore. Well, he doesn't like sucking. Why would he suck? Because he doesn't, you know, best-selling author. It would be bitter for him to fail. And then Todd McFarlane, covered up with glory, you know, why would he want to fail? Ken Ralston, internationally celebrated game designer, award-winning games.
Oh, yeah.
He's a living god. He has to be good. And he loves role-playing games because he's been around since there was dirt. He's done paper and pencil, all that stuff. So you should say, a lot of people have their ass on the line on this who could probably not – they could just take a pass on this. Why take a risk on making – okay, terrible idea. Never make a role-playing game at all because it's way too hard. And then never make a new IP at all. Never. It's the silliest thing you do. Never try to communicate the virtues of a role-playing game and a new IP in a two-minute video. Okay, totally bad idea. So why am I telling you that you do this? Because you like role-playing games. Mm-hmm. And this is a good place to take a chance on it. And because, as Joe said, we wanted something with combat that didn't suck. I mean, that's probably as simple as we can put it. Right. And some of us have already expressed some discontent with combat. How do you think I feel, pal, having been making games all this time? And, it's not like I wasn't having fun. It's not like people didn't have fun with those games. They were great, but they are not the best that could be. I played other games and had fun on them. And I played God of War, totally didn't like the linear gameplay, and there was no richness to it. Kind of a nice story concept, but it really has no presence in the story for me. So
well, why can't I do that, you know, in a role-playing game? And it turns out because I don't know how and because I'm an idiot and nobody in the role-playing game think we don't have those skills. We don't know what Joe knows about, you know, what is it, frame advantage?
Yeah.
When you're talking Greek to me, what the hell is frame advantage?
Hit reacts and frame advantage and timing.
I don't know. So I knew I wanted a combat game, but I had no idea how to do it. And guess who was the poor bastard who had to do that? I'm pointing at Joe.
Yeah, it was a lot of responsibility sort of coming in and having sort of this goal of giving good action game combat to an RPG. And everybody there already had done RPGs. Ian Fraser, the lead designer, had done Titan Quest and an Ultima mod, and he knew RPGs also. So he's got all the stats going up and down the place, and nobody is understanding sort of the animation timing bit of it that I'm trying to bring to the table. And I started realizing that we might have some fights and blood in the halls. And I had to grab Ken by the collar and be just like, you need to tell me what the essence is of an RPG so I don't kill it.
What, and I got to get this. Not from Ken. What do you remember about what Ken told you?
No,
was
it's
the
great.
Essence?
It's that the perception that the investment of time is simulating growth in skill or whatever else. So it's that I'm investing time into this world, that there's always going to be role-playing. I don't care what game it is. It could be the most ridiculous action game. Even the JRPGs, you are role-playing a very specific character often through there. So it's not so much about always the choice, although we love choice. It's about that investment of time telling me that I'm getting better. And I think anything that I do, I'm probably going to get better at it just by doing it. So you will get better at a role-playing game by playing it, but the best thing about a role-playing game is you can grind and you can show that you are better. Mm-hmm. So that being sort of the piece of it.
Tangible rewards.
Yeah. Yeah. So
or intangible rewards, but they're there. I mean, we can quantifiable rewards.
And
we can look at
number.
It and say, hey, I'm getting this number that's better.
I was level 5. Now I'm level 6.
Yeah.
I'm better. And so being able to see that in the game, as long as I didn't kill that, we were going to be okay. So then everything falls from that. That's why we show damage numbers on screen. That's why we show how much damage your sword is doing. That's why we show the armor value, because all these numbers mean something to you. You want to know that this new shiny iron armor is better than your crude rusty armor.
And I think it's time now to talk about story, because it's a bad game that doesn't have a good story. And I'll tell you how I know when it's time to make a new role-playing game in a new IP. It's when I have a premise for the persona of the player that not only doesn't suck, it's awesome. And when I do the Snoopy dance and I run around from office to office and make people want to drive me out, you know, with torches and, you know, and pitchforks, because I said to myself, we looked around in the 10,000 years of history that R.A. Salvatore and 38 Studios created. And by the way, parentheses, wow, what an awesome treat that is to not have to do the work first. Let's be honest, I'm a deadbeat. But let's also say, what an awesome thing to read it anxious. Well, this is an internationally celebrated writer. I mean, you know, I've not been a New York Times bestseller. I'm sorry to say. My wife has noted this a number of times, pointedly to me.
Needless to say, I won't be alone looking for Drizzt.
Yeah, it's you know, okay. It was totally awesome to have him do the work and have it be wonderful. And parentheses, we looked around into that 10,000 years and tried to find a place that would be really cool. And I'm looking for something where you're going to be the players. You have to know who you are. It has to be compelling. It has to imply a story. And that suspense about that story extends into the distance. And then I can have a great payoff on the end of it at a reversal. So what I'm saying is, well, look, this is a world that in the future, a lot of people are immortal. In the past, there was a time when the first man was immortal. And then I look for that spot. And where I find out is that the first – I make this up, by the way. I'm pretending that it was written in there all along. I you know, my favorite phrase is, I bet you didn't know. You know, and I'll shake my finger. I bet you didn't know that the first guy to ever be immortal, nobody knows why he was – because they had been trying for a lot and they've been – you know, there's stacks of failures. And the failures are bad because they turn into zombies and wander around. They're awful. You know, so – it's a really hard-nosed scientist that keeps making things like this that are just disgusting. And then you wake up in a pile of bodies. And you are the guy that should have just been a zombie or a pile of meat, and you woke up. Okay, this is exciting. It's the first time it's ever happened. We happen to know in Christianity that's a model. We're talking about big, you know, mythic Jungian archetypes. That's amazing. But not only that, you have no idea who you are, and you have no idea why you came back. And in fact, you talk to the guy who was managed to make you come back. He says, yeah, I don't know, something weird. You know, I have no idea how that happened. So, okay, there's a mystery. And let's then set that aside for a second. We've got, you know, a great premise for who you are. Let's imagine what happened in a world where the first person is immortal. Do you think some people would be interested in that? Do you think that could be marketable, for example?
Nah.
And would those people cross the planet cheerfully and question you closely, probably with long-pointed things, on how I could go about getting me some of that sweet, sweet stuff? Now, it just so happens that when you come up, wake up from the dead people, people are trying to kill you. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I did. What's going on? What's happening? You know, okay. So, but nonetheless, it turns out when bad people are killing you in a role-playing game, you know what you're supposed to be doing. Killing those bad people. And since you're a badass, of course, you're doing badass killing. And interestingly enough, as you walk up the chain, there are more badass bad people that you can kill so that you get better and better at this. And then let's take this mystery one other step. It turns out that that mystery you discover through people that you meet that there's something amazing about you that's unlike anybody in history. You don't seem to have a fate. If you lived in a world where you could walk, you know, like let's imagine your guidance counselor is your fate weaver. You go to your guidance counselor and he says, okay, this is what you're going to do. This is what your career is going to be. You know, it just so happens you're going to be a chartered accountant, you know, and your life falls apart right before you when he reads that. But you can't have opinions about it. It's just true.
It's like the career chips in Futurama. They imprint you and that's what you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's genuine determinism. But then this guy, who is a fate weaver, like your guidance counselor, he tries to find out what's going on. He says, uh-oh, something's wrong. And he's banging his equipment. He's saying, oh, this must be broken. You don't seem to have a fate. And that makes you special. So you spend all your time wandering around trying to find somebody who can figure out how this works. The fate weaver tries to help you. And by the way, a great number one, you trust these people, the guy that tried to bring you back, you know, from death, because you trust him. He's interested. He wants to know how it happened because he's been trying for so long. He's motivated. And then Agarth, who is the guy who discovers that you have no fate, he says, it turns out that when miracles happen, I get interested. I find them really compelling stories. I would like to know what your story is. And those people are moving you in the direction of the bad people, the badass bad people who are trying to kill you, which you're having fun killing because you're getting more and more badass. And there's an end somewhere. And that's the end that you're being drawn to. And that's what I know as a game designer. That's the end of my premise. That's where the fun part's going to be, where you had better be really badass or you don't leave the room at the end of the game.
Hmm. And, of course, during that entire path, you've got reagents that are pulling you off the main quest. And
of course.
Alchemy quests and crafting quests to build all your new stuff. So there's always
sort of chickens, which must die.
Or
they
kicked.
Cluck. Oh, my God. No. I hate chickens. I will cross a large field to kill every chicken.
You'll cross the road to kick the chicken.
Oh, no, I can't kick them. I must murder them. That's often, right. I will stealth kill the chickens.
So I have to stop and ask one of my most wondered questions that I have oftentimes about fantasy worlds, and this is it's somewhat rhetorical because I don't know that there is a hard and fast answer for it, which is that there are, and this is not an aspersion in any way, there are a number of fantastic stories and concepts for heroes and archetypes, and yet the differentiating point often comes down to, for instance, Joe, you were talking about playing Dungeon Siege. Tell me the world that Dungeon Siege exists in. Tell me the name of one of the important gods of the Dungeon Siege world.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Because it's the fantasy gobbledygook. And so often it really falls off the edge of the cliff into fantasy gobbledygook. And it seems so elusive of how do you create that meaty piece that gets you so that when you read Kingdoms of Amalur Reckoning, you read Kingdoms of Amalur Reckoning and not Kingdoms of What the hell is this?
You're far too articulate and word trapped. You're too much a victim of the Gutenberg culture.
Okay.
What you want to do is see a world. When I know that Egyptians are cool, it's because their mummies look totally cool. And the last thing in the world in a role-playing game I want, although I will give you all a lot more of it than you want, is exposition. There's nothing more soul-crushing and pace-killing than exposition. I happen to believe this: the world should tell the story. And that as you're running along and you see something beside you which looks like a giant Thebes, you know, with monuments and things like that, whether you can name those monuments or not is not as important to me as you say, wow, that's striking. Wow, that's mythic, and it's a mystery. So I think it's the unarticulate, you know, you don't have to know who the gods are. I can't tell you who the gods of Hinduism are. It's not like I didn't even, I studied them and I can't remember, but that's not the point. I know them in their infinite form. And I suspect, because I can see all of them, that they all have a different meaning to different people. So your ability to label them or to remember the labels is not as important as creating that visual thing. And then the immersive experience is, I'm a tourist. Where was the last place you went on vacation for the first time in your life?
The last place I went for the first time in my life? I don't know. Someplace in Japan, probably.
Okay. You will not be able to name the stores on the sidewalk.
No,
none of that stuff. But you will have impressions. And our job is to make sure you get those impressions. And it's, I think that's a far more compelling sense of place. That sense of I don't even know why I know that I'm in another place.
So it's more like a visceral than an academic approach.
Yeah, so you can use the visceral.
I hate using that word, but
no, but it's the right word. Yeah. We've worn the word out. The word is still true, and that's what I'm looking for.
I can give it some detail. I mean, speaking to Dungeon Seed specifically, it's got this top-down camera. It's very removed, and I'm playing this loot sort of damage game, and I can tell it's a loot damage game. And I think the fact that it looks like a board game, the way that I interact with the world, I'm able to sort of abstract it to numbers more.
Mm-hmm.
When we do Kingdoms of Amalur Reckoning, we bring the camera in closer. We give you movement that feels more fluid and it feels like you're moving through the world because we want you to be more immersed. So we do all this stuff with camera and animation and the dialogue system to make it feel that you are actually in this world. And when you're moving from place to place, you feel like you're moving from a new place with a name to another new place with a name, and there's a different, so you can feel the wetness in the air, or it gets dark and Grant Kirkhope's music comes in and you can tell that this place is unique and special. When I play a game like Dungeon Siege, I think that big first step is the camera pulling me back so far and the game telling me that it's really just about these numbers here, it's not about anything else, that makes me forget all the names and the lore.
And yet at the same time, they go for a more photo-like environmental design and visual design. Same thing as Morrowind and Oblivion. Mm-hmm. and et al. And yet you guys have gone for a more stylized look to the world. And how does that relate into where you were going with it, Ken?
Joe is as articulate
okay,
on this.
Sure. Share it.
Go.
I think really it's about being able to use contrast more. And if you talk about contrast is just a great language for video games. It's how I know that I'm moving from a bad space to a good space, from a scary space to a happy space. And when you have a large color palette and you can use a more stylized art set, then we can bring sort of the caves can feel darker. They can feel wetter. They can feel they have more echo and horror to them. And then when you move out into a nice place, and RA talks about this concept of building a world that you want to save, we can show it feels more like it's a world you want to save because it's more beautiful and more lush, especially coming out of the very dark Well of Souls place that you just came from, where there's dead people and flies and green goop hanging from everything.
Well, having been to Menzo Barons, and I kind of got the idea. Likes that kind of land.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm grinning like a madman because Joe is so articulate about this. So our message has to be great internally, but I think the message also is that this art, this contrast, this style, it also has the virtue of not being just like – this is hyphenated with capitals – just like every other damn game I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that what it'll do is it'll feel different, and I want – okay, it's a simple thing. I want more fun per unit time.
And I think there's more fun per unit time looking at our screens. I'm not saying they're not. Maybe their other games are more immersive. Maybe there are other things that other games can do in some other way. But what I want is fun.
See, now this is a good thing because I can really, really latch onto this because I've been playing a ton of Skyrim. And while I've been playing Skyrim, Ariel's been playing Bayonetta. So now here is a really big juxtaposition between amazing, crazy action happening all the time, ginormous fights, tons of enemies, flashy combat, great combo system, and
run head first into your enemy, swing
running like a panther.
And I just killed a dragon, and now a bear just kicked my ass, and you know, so it's a very, very like, and even with fast travel, I still run into these long stretches of go here, talk to this person, follow this person, go out here, watch this happen, listen to this exposition, go over here, do this something else, and then when I finally get to fight somebody, I fight a couple of somebodies, but I never get to like really get in there and just freaking go loose.
Oh hell, you can in Skyrim, you can go play 6 hours without fighting a thing if you want. I mean, if you want, if that's the way you're playing your character, then that's, I mean, and I think part of that is because the combat just isn't as compelling as, you know.
So the point of all that was, what pushed you to get into that mindset of in an RPG, which doesn't seem like people worry about that a lot, of I want to have more action per minute?
We took the road less traveled. I think of, again, there are many roads to enlightenment. And I say that ironically because I'm a creepy old enlightened man. But I actually mean it in every way. And I also choosing that road less traveled was more exciting for me because it was more dangerous and more charming. But also in a marketing sense, I felt like, you know, let's go into a market with something special. And a lot of the things that you see in Reckoning are special. The question is it what the other people want? Who knows? Because it hasn't been done before. That excites me. Money hats, it may fill with nameless dread, but that's okay. You know, why should they be comfortable?
I think also it's a function of just how you've built the game. And I'm thinking in our game, combat is so much fun. So we are able to pace combat encounters much more frequent without you getting bored or feeling like you want to run away. And this is probably just the way that Skyrim's combat has sort of forced them into that level design, is that maybe it isn't that fun, so that you don't see it that often, because they realized if they had as much combat as we would, then you might be...
You're like, oh,
you'd be annoyed.
I'm wailing away on another thing with my right
shoulder. You're throwing turpentine on the painting.
Right. I'm thinking of like Double Dragon and how terrible their sort of spike trap puzzles were. And if you had a level that was all spike traps, I would never play that game. But if it was all baseball bats and guys to hit with baseball bats, that's a fun game.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
So I guess the question I have, if we're going to talk about combat for a second, is this. I've only had a chance to play about an hour and a half, 2 hours of Kingdoms of Amalur, which took me through the beginning, so I'm just getting my feet wet in it. And I'm relating somewhat, and I think this is a natural relationship a lot of people will have, to Fable. Because Fable also, one of the things that, you know, Peter wanted to get there with was this idea of not being distracted by combat combos and all that kind of stuff, but using, you know, paying attention to what your character is doing in the screen, following the animations, and using buttons to sort of orchestrate, like a conductor would conduct the tempo of the combat, which was fun, except that you realized pretty quickly that certain things happened in a certain order, and it felt like once you got accustomed to it, it needed a layer of depth. Okay, so Joe, without blowing too much smoke up your skirt, I think that you guys hit right off the bat really well with the idea of if I'm watching my character play, there's a definite familiarity I can gain with where if I'm swinging my sword, I know that if I wait through X, I'm moving my arm, I wish we had video. If I wait through where my arm, you know, my wrist is crossing my chest and then press the button, that I'll get one counter out of that. If I wait a little bit lower, I get another one. And in some cases, depending on my weapon, if I wait all the way till the stroke's finished, I'll get indeed a different sort of response out of that. So now I'm getting the contextual part of it. What's next? I mean, am I getting the whole thing? Because I start to think, then I think about that experience of playing my role-playing game while watching Bayonetta and thinking, but Bayonetta, I get, you know, BB down X, or I get BBA quarter circle A. And I don't know, do I want that? Do you want me to have that, or do I not want to have that?
I would say you want that. The ideal situation, if we could have a 100-button controller, is you'd have a different button for every action so that you know, I want this sword strike, then I want my launching sword strike, and then I want the one that slams them into the ground and swings them around into everybody. So you sort of have these three-button attacks. But the problem is, I think you just hit on it, was the BBXY and having to memorize all that stuff. And Bayonetta tried to solve it by showing you the move list in the loading screen just to help you remind you about, oh yeah, there's
a little moves. Practice time.
I haven't used this move before. Let's see if I can. I can't even do this, but because it's like five button combination that requires me to go back and forth between all these things. So what we landed on was a good.
Someone knows exactly what you're talking about.
So we landed on this thing where we have five really solid ways to input your attacks, and these are the ways that you sort of level up your weapons throughout the game. And we tested them, and we tested them over and over again. We tried ones that we thought would work, and then had to come back and say, no, this doesn't work. So we let it to be easy enough to input that you don't have to memorize it, and then that was the key. So we will give you as many attacks as you can input without having to memorize or it being too difficult. So
okay.
Hold attacks, you can block and attack out of hold, you can do your delay attacks like you're talking about, attacks out of stealth, and sort of we build this language for you so that you know what to expect. And if you discover something with the two-handed sword, you can go look at it with the daggers then.
That's the important thing. We don't want you to have to read about it. Matter of fact, Brian Reynolds always talked to me, spoke the gospel of discoverability, because there's nothing more satisfying than having a weapon and thinking that it does something really useful and then suddenly saying, oh, it does that too? That's awesome. Yeah, and in the tutorial, you know, by the way, I don't play fight games, so that when I swung my sword and then just happened to delay it longer than I normally did and until it was at the bottom, bang, it knocked the guy into the air, and I was so shocked. I didn't have any fun at that point. I said, what happened? What was that? And then when I realized, I get to juggle him. I've heard of juggling in other games before. I can't believe. And then what you do is you juggle everything, not because it's useful, because it's awesome and it looks cool.
Right.
That's the discoverability, and that's what Joe is talking about. If you have a limited language that creates a lot of variety using different weapons and contexts, then you discover it by playing. We give you a lot of combat, make it pretty so you don't mind doing that, and then the deliciousness is, I just discovered I'm so awesome and I see how awesome I am. Oh, that's so cool. And you wave your hands. I'm doing a little Snoopy paddle thing. That's what you do.
The Snoopy paddle thing is good.
Yeah, it's perfect.
That should be a combo right there.
Treading water like right. Snoopy. Yeah.
So ultimately, pulling this thing together, as you guys have done, obviously you're right at certification or end of certification, hopefully. What was the sort of nexus for pulling together the yellow brick road of story, the background of character development, and then the heavy combat piece, so that you have all those pieces working together? What was the nexus that, like, oh, this is clicking, this is working?
That's where production comes in. We had to know, and one of the thing that's impossible about a role-playing game is you have to produce a lot of content. And Joe's talking about when we figured we had something that would work, we couldn't possibly have tested it at all, but nonetheless, we knew where we were going with all that stuff. We had in documents. We knew the plan was good.
And I said, trust me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, that's essentially what it is. We say, trust me, and then it generate endless quantities of stuff and then get it great. So it's almost like very early in the project was the climax of the story, and the rest of it is just not fucking up.
Important part.
No, but you say that. Well, of all games, suck button off is probably the thing that's hardest to do, and it's hardest to do in the most difficult games. MMOs, for example, right. And role-playing games. And for a company that had never done an MMO before with a new IP, suck button off, really important. Partly just for basic reasons, but because we're concerned with user experience and we test for it. So
Ken said MMO, but he meant single-player RPG.
Yeah, I'm old. Stuff falls out. It's not important. It's all burned up there from the 60s.
But if you're listening right now and you want to build your trust button up, there's a demo. You can get it right now. And a matter of fact, if you go and play the demo, you'll get a little added bonus for Mass Effect 3. Nice little tie-in synergy between role-playing game there. So do that right now. It is available on Xbox Live and on the PlayStation Network. We are going to take a quick little break. When we come back on the other side, we still have lots of other things to talk about, but I'm going to have to do this for Shacknews. I got to ask one quick question about PC versions, so we'll do that to kick off the next phase when we come back on Weekend Confirmed. All right, thanks for sticking with us through that break. Much appreciated. I wanted to ask real quickly to you guys, because we focus, I think a lot of attention has been on Reckoning's console versions. There's a PC version coming, folks. And by the way, lest I be late on doing this, the demo is out on next Tuesday, the 17th.
17th, yep.
It is out on PSN, Xbox Live,
yep,
and PC. Correct. You guys have a PC version coming.
Yes.
Absolutely. Big Huge Games is a PC studio. You remember they did Rise of Nations and Rise of Legends. So
two of the best strategy. I mean, I'm an old real-time strategy guy. Those games were freaking genius.
Let me share a juicy bit about the PC thing. If you're playing with an Xbox controller into your PC, and you will find that your interface is context-sensitive, if you use the keyboard and the mouse, it will instantly and seamlessly switch back and forth. This is an amazing thing. It's crazy talk, totally crazy talk. And it could be just to show off to start with. I mean, but right now I'm finding I do it and I didn't realize I was doing it.
Oh, you switch between the two?
You can switch it. Yeah. You just say, I got my thing. I'm sorry, I'm gesturing with moving back and forth with my hands on the controller to reaching out to touching the keyboard and the mouse sometimes. I have a feeling that if you are a multitasking gadget geek, which I'm not, you may even find it more seductive. But the basic thing is it won't fail you as it does in some other games when you've got that thing in there and then you say, can I use my keyboard? No, you can't. They're locked out.
And I think that speaks to how we developed the game is that we were always developing it with the controller in mind and the keyboard and mouse in mind. And so when we went to develop both SKUs, our interface guy said, well, you know what? If you touch anything on the Xbox controller, then it'll just switch to the whole interface. And if you touch the keyboard, it'll just switch back to the keyboard. So it was like really a natural thing to do, but no one...
But not obvious to people who are used to their chains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I'm very curious which way I'll play this now because I've just become the owner of a new gaming system.
Ooh.
And the thought of, you know, relaxedly playing this game with a controller but getting it at, you know, 1920 or, you know, whatever kind of crazy resolution I want to, but also with, you know, crunching it through my 580. That sounds pretty appealing.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty appealing.
We are not insensible to that.
Yeah. I'm a gamer, so I like sitting on my couch, but at the same time, I know the PC looks really amazing at high resolution, so I'm torn.
Yeah. Well, it works in both ways. Yeah. So there you go. So on Tuesday, grab the demo, and then you can hop into the comment thread for this show and interact with us and tell us your opinion after playing. Where's the demo section carved out of the game?
It's going to be the whole beginning of the game, so the opening cinematic, character creation, and then sort of the Well of Souls mystery that you're going to learn that you die.
Oh, so it's going to give it away. You're going to give away right off the bat?
Yep, give that whole beginning of the game.
No, we give away the premise, which is what you need to know who you are. We don't tell you any of the answers to the mysteries.
And then, so once you've exited that area, then you have a 45-minute timer that says go explore. We've given you two really large zones, but it's really, I think, only like 1/10 of the game.
That's way smaller than a tenth if you take a look at the map.
Is it?
Yeah, always scary.
1/20th?
Then? It might well be. I don't know. I'm bluffing. I have no idea.
All right. So you guys have finally gotten free of the shackles of having to work on all those stuff. And did you escape to play anything for fun or get away to have any fun over the holidays or anything?
Yes. I've been playing Battlefield 3 with the combat team at work, which is a lot of fun. We get in early and get in around 8 o'clock and play Battlefield up until If Kurt's listening, 9 o'clock.
And if Kurt's not listening?
10.
Oh, just nice. 10. Nice.
Well, we also play at lunch and then after work also. I've been playing Chrono Trigger on the DS just sort of during the holidays. And then I finally got Yakuza 4 in my PS3 because I've been wanting to play that for a long time.
Oh, man. You know I'm a Yakuza fan. I'm a huge Yakuza fan, but I get taken to task all the time because I've finished one, partly finished two, and not gotten to 3 and 4. And people are like, what the hell's wrong with you?
I skipped 3.
Yeah, it's because of the localization.
I just forgot it was out.
That's fair.
I have 4 on it was on top of my PS3. I was like, oh, I must have played 3. And then halfway through 4,
isn't 3?
Yeah.
But did you play 1 and 2?
I did play 1 and 2.
So what do you think about playing on PS3? What's the jump like?
You know, it feels like it's the same game, but I know it's not. It's like the characters actually, let me rephrase that. The cinematics and the characters' resolution is amazing.
Right.
The game feels pretty similar, but they have sort of improved the sort of accessibility of how I can dodge and stuff out of combos, which I really love. And then I love bashing guys' heads into rails. That's just, it just looks better.
Or taking a bike and smashing it over their head.
Yeah. Right. But it's exactly what I want, really. They didn't add too much stuff that I don't want. Although I do sort of get bored putting makeup on girls in the hostess clubs.
Yeah.
They made me do that a lot longer than I thought I would have to do it.
Yeah, the tutorial is a little longer.
You have to do it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
In 4?
In 4, yeah. They force you through it.
That's kind of an odd disconnect. I mean, but then that's a careful what you wish for, right? If you're if you're a fan of game types, careful what you wish for, because that is probably the backlash to, okay, 3, they got taken to task for cutting stuff out from the Japanese version they thought wouldn't play well. So obviously here they didn't filter it at all. They said, okay, fine, we'll just translate it all. Here you go. Have fun. Take loose.
Except they made me do it. But I think it works as a tutorial. It's just I spent 2 hours sort of dressing this doll up, basically.
See, people think I'm nuts, but I actually like Nagoshi's style, and I'm somehow like, I'm kind of convinced I'm going to like Binary Domain, and people think that I'm absolutely insane for that.
I don't even know.
I'd fun with the demo at E3. I mean, it was early, but it's kind of cool.
Tell me about Binary Domain.
Binary Domain is a very anime-influenced, squad-based shooter sort of thing, where there's a two-tiered future version of Tokyo, where, of course, people in the top tier are all, you know, the fortunate ones and fantastic society living up there, and also free of the cyborgs who there have apparently somehow gone haywire, and there's, you know, it's like a sort of Skynet. I don't exactly understand. I'm probably messing it up some, but there's like a Skynet thing going on.
I love Aldous Huxley. I'm reading 1984 right now.
Main, you know, like in the old traditional level is where the robots have gone haywire, and you're part of this squad that is fighting against them. I forget why you're fighting against them, but you're fighting against them. But then the thing that brings in like the whole very Japanese style thing to it is that they built in all of these crazy character relationships between one another, and you know, they just have a sensibility of like, don't give a damn and be crazy with that stuff that I don't know.
He does characters well. Yeah,
my gunner doesn't like my medic. I gotta fix up my squad. I mean, like, that's, right. That's kind of what it is.
No, that's
like,
what it is.
Sure, yeah.
Or, you know, like the sniper's a hot chick. So if you look at her ass, she gets pissed off about it, maybe. Or maybe she likes it. Maybe it works out.
You never know.
You never know.
Probably doesn't like it very much. I'm just guessing.
You know, it's always good to fish outside your own pond, right?
Dead silence.
I don't know if I should say yes or no to that.
Eyes cast to the ceiling.
I'm confused
bad for
by
the
your
squad,
career.
Man. You don't want to, like, the rivalries. Like, what if the heavy gunner also had the hots for her? Then, you know, he doesn't want to cover you. He, like, shoots you in the back.
I think that's cool.
You're bringing a lot to this, I think. But okay, but nonetheless, sure. Good baggage. Like, baggage, good.
Well, you were talking about Walking Dead earlier. That's like character interactions, right?
Right,
like,
yeah, exactly.
That's,
see?
That's the game that I want.
Yeah. Same sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, so what are you guys' take on Battlefield? You know, a lot of the Shackers are super into Battlefield, but it's been, you know, like there's definitely a line in the sand in that one.
The first month I missed Commander mode a lot, and I think now that I've been playing so much more Conquest, I'm okay that I don't have it. But I still think you talk me into missing Commander mode again, because that was just a cool thing, being able to drop care packages for a squad that was doing really well. And you may only have enough care packages just for that squad, but because he's doing really well, you don't care. And there's some annoying kid in Strike at Karkin saying, give me care package, drop a Jeep. And you're like, no, you just would waste it, squander it. So I think that's the main thing for me. Rush mode, I don't feel as much. I really like Conquest.
You're not feeling the rush, though.
No, it. I think it does a good battle simulation, but some of the too much corridors, I think. So you end up sort of with this battle lane that's just a hallway and a bunch of bullets just going down the hallway and medics just amping up their medic score. Right. And it's not really simulating any sort of push and pull. There's a good front line, which I love, but there's no flanking.
That's a good point. There's a good front line, which is one of the things I like about it. But you're right that it's really difficult because if you bring in much flanking, then, you know, with
it's too hard to defend and
limited team size, and you got to control. I mean, you are actually trying to control a game experience. It's the same thing as like when you guys are setting up combat design in the scenario. You know, there's only so far you can push it. You could say, oh, well, it'd be really cool if we had, you know, another cave entrance over here, and then had, you know, an alternate where things could come out of here. But eventually, you might overwhelm the ability of the player to keep up with it.
Did you say what platform you're playing on?
I'm playing on PC.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wise choice.
I gotta have to play FPSs on the PC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have to play FPSs on the PC, huh?
Unless it's Halo. That's the only one I'll play on an Xbox, but that's just because it's built for that controller. But yeah, I'm mouse and keyboard all the way.
Given the option.
Yeah. If it's multi-platform, yeah.
Great. Did you play Bulletstorm?
I did not, no.
Oh, you should.
I played the demo.
You should hop in the Bulletstorm. There's a reason it made a lot of, you know, we're just doing our Game of the Year Game of the Year selections, and we had a tough time with them because, you know, just awarding 10, we were doing 5 honorable mentions and then, you know, top slotted 5, and just doing our personal staff picks of games that we liked that didn't make it, there's another two dozen games that were like, wow, any of these games are well deserved of being in, you know, an end of the year list, and they're not getting there for some reason.
I think, yeah, we've hit the point at the end of these console life cycles where games are just solid across the board, and it's really hard to sort of pick your favorites. Yeah.
Okay. What else have you guys been dabbling in? Ken, what have you been up to?
I've been playing Heroes of Might and Magic 5, and mostly it's just constantly researching other fantasy styles of games that I might be able to hybridize with a role playing game and have a different kind of experience. So I'm just staying, you know, up to date with different kinds of experiences, different kinds of
into the
themes and stories. Yeah, yeah. Well, I had never played them when they came out, and I just thought it'd be interesting to see what they're like. And I've been playing Skyrim because I was unable to play it for so long, everybody else was talking about it. And I felt bad because I wanted to be able to tell my friends how much I liked it. And I was, you feel a little uncertain about it. And then luckily, I didn't feel uncertain about it at all. I loved a lot of it. And admittedly, I've grown to love my chains. I mean, I made many of them, so it's my own goddamn problem. Mm-hmm. But I just, little things that I find totally satisfying is that when Lydia is in a door behind me, and I want to move back, I turn back toward her and kind of press into her, and she gets out of the way. Oh, my God. What a heroic piece of AI stuff. Right. You know, it doesn't work with a Frost Atronox or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you need to be grateful for every gift that you're given. You know, it's a game that's delightful in so many ways, and then there are going to be so many blemishes that you could talk about, and I just never care about those. The thing I love about Bethesoft is that it's jazz. There are just so many notes, you know, and there are so many notes for everybody, and different people like different parts of it, and it's an amazing experience. And I always feel that experience, and this is the first one I've ever been able to play without designing. So it was really kind of delicious. It was really sweet.
What did you play? What's your, gotta tell me, like, what's the character class? And
I always play screaming, terrified girl pilgrim. A pilgrim in the sense that, see, I used to play the victim class, and I would deliberately build a character who would die in a heavy wind, or there was a little turbulence on the water or something like that. It's because my experience is I love putting myself in terrible situations and getting away with it. I'm not a power gamer. I think that's what it is. Gaming is delicious. And when I play power gaming, by the way, which I do a lot in Reckoning, because it seduces that part of it. But what I like to do is I like to say, I'm going to have a terrifying experience as much as I can. I'm going to walk into a dark place with only a small pointy thing. And it's because I say, I'm going to be doing a lot of running in that space. And I sneak very carefully, and I shoot things from a million miles away. And if I don't kill them instantly, I'm on my way out the door before I can tell whether I hit them. You know, it's just a. I guess it's because it's a game that supports role playing. For me, of course, I'm bringing a lot to the experience.
Oh, right.
But nonetheless, it supports that, and that's just that's so delicious. By the way, watching me play it. And it used at Bethsoff, people would want to kill me. My pace is so slow, and I'm so careful. And they go, "Come on, do something for God's sake! Don't be such a girl." Yeah. But that's who I am.
Joe, do you have that trouble with him on Reckoning?
I do not know.
Around?
I think I remember. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. He called me into the office, and he was doing this type of imaginative role playing. And he's like, "I'm playing a rogue who doesn't really want to." And I can't remember what it was, but it was just like, "This isn't the normal way to play the game." But once I broke myself out of that, and he was just telling me, "I want this tool to assist me in my role playing." And I realized that's what Ken does. He just goes in with his imagination, creates an archetype, and then wants to play the game that way. And if he runs into a wall where he says, "I can no longer play this character anymore," then he would just sort of raise his hands and say, "Excuse me, my imagination just broke.
I have a great idea. I think this is time for warfare between Joe and I." Because there's a special feature that Joe and I differ on. And the default feature is Joe's default. But I want to
warn
everybody to go, because he has the moral high ground.
Ooh,
I'm enlightened by my desire for novelty. He's got the moral high ground. So what we ought to do is, why don't you, this is a point counterpoint. Go ahead.
Is this sprint?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not exactly sure where I land on this. I just know.
You're so wishy-washy.
Yeah, I'm terrible. Here's where I'll say what I think you're saying. What you think I'm saying? I want the player to be able to hold a button to sprint.
Yes.
Okay. There we go. That is the way.
He wants them to be able to, in the same sense as they have to or they can't sprint.
Are we clear?
Yeah. You seem to be finessing it like a lawyer or a politician. I'm not sure that he was genuinely.
Now what's the alternative?
We're not in conference room A anymore.
Morally wrong. I think when you want to start to sprint, you press the button one time and the game knows you pressed it and keeps it in its mind, like computers are really good at doing, until you run into something or you deliberately tell it to stop running.
Right. And just to sort of take the wind out of the debate real quick, I think that is it's a great idea because it's a left stick click to sprint, like in the Call of Duty series or whatever. You don't need to hold the left stick in to sprint, although many people do. You just click it.
It's like a toggle.
So Ken posited
that. I want a toggle.
Yeah, so Ken said press or hold A to toggle sprint, and at first I thought it was crazy, and I realized, wait a second, it's just like left stick click, and I implemented it, and everybody loved it because you can move the camera around while you're sprinting, and it's just what everybody wanted, but I didn't make it the default, and I think that's where Ken is happy.
I want righteous indignation. I want people in the streets shouting Joe's name.
I agree. I think it's the better solution. I think it's new. That's the problem. And so to make it the default, people don't understand that it's doing what it's doing until they actually go read the description and say, that's what I want.
But I can switch that in the interface.
Yeah.
There you go.
So when you start your demo, please go switch that in.
Because switch sprint to the right way.
Options, under options.
Yeah. I agree. That's what you should do.
I'm just relieved that neither of you were taking the position that to tap the sprint button was right. I was like, please.
You have to mash it 4 times a second.
Yeah.
Actually, the animation is very detailed, so you have to actually catch the sprint right when the footfall hits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The toe.
Modeling.
Specifically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Inversive. Modeling.
I actually did try that. And
did you really?
You never did.
No, I did. I wanted something to make it kind of, it would be, sprinting would be just sort of its own thing, but if you caught the footfalls, you could actually get a little speed boost or something, because I just love little things like that, but it was too hard.
You're animated with like a little poof of dirt, you saw that you got
sparkles.
Sparkles!
No. It didn't even get to the point where I could go to an effects guy and ask for sparkles. It was just like, no, this isn't fun.
I am flabbergasted and in awe.
Oh, I'm crazy.
I celebrate you. You're crazier than I am. God bless you.
Jeff, what have you been playing? Anything interesting there, sir?
Yeah, a bunch of indie stuff, actually. There's a couple of games that are about to come out in the next few months. One called Catapult for Hire, which I believe I talked about briefly. It is looks like a retro, like a Nintendo game. So this sort of the cel-shaded visuals, very bright colors. It takes place in a medieval economy that has collapsed, and you're a knight, and there's no kingdoms worth conquering or, you know, dragons to slay. So you decide to take your catapult out and, you know, take up odd jobs for the kingdom townsfolk. So you're doing stuff like, okay, you know, traditional catapult stuff like knocking stuff down.
But then flinging cows? Do you get to fling cows?
Rabbits. I haven't flung any cows yet.
You have to be able to fling a cow.
You can fish with your catapult. So they have like different lures that you fire into the water. And then, you know, for example, one of the lures, the very basic lure, you just wait for a fish to bite and then you reel it in and stuff. There's different types of fish. There's all these different little creative, totally atypical applications for catapult uses. There's catapult golf is in there.
Of course.
It's
awesome.
It was sweeping medieval universities well before frisbee golf.
Yeah. So it's as great as it sounds. It's very, very surprisingly well written.
PC, I take it?
PC.
Cool.
And coming out, not out yet, but keep your eye out for it.
All right. So we can link that up in the show notes where you can go check out a little Catapult for Hire.
Correct. I also played a little bit of Cube, which just came out on Steam. It's like a first-person puzzle game. You look at it, immediately you think, oh, this looks like Portal. It's really not. It's basically about manipulating different colored cubes in different ways. So there's one that, you know, you can push it in and it acts as a springboard. There's another, you know, red cubes you can pull out of walls, you know, three notches to use as stepladders. There's yellow cubes that form into stairs when you activate them. It's just all these, and then they start layering on all this additional stuff. So you're rotating parts of the room. You're doing puzzles in the dark. It's very good for a puzzle game. It's sort of, you know, if you're expecting Portal, don't, because it doesn't have that narrative component that that really, really makes that game special. Again, puzzles are great, but it's sort of like, I don't know. It's a great first person puzzle game, I guess, but it doesn't have that narrative component. So, you know, if that's important to you,
fair enough.
Okay,
fair enough.
And the other one that I really want to sort of highlight, actually a couple.
Other one. You only get one more.
Okay. The only other one. Then I'll highlight one that's actually out.
What a tyrant!
I know. Evil.
There is a 3D tower defense game called Terrorhedron. Terrorhedron.
T-E-R-R-O-R?
Yeah.
Ha 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 ha.
Ha ha.
Sorry.
And its
sequel will be Tetraterrorhedron.
And it is a 3D tower defense game that supports up to 8-player co-op. And it's the reason, it's basically, you're dealing with these really labyrinthian maze-like environments. So, you know, you can move the camera around at any angle, you know, the creeps or the little terrorhedrons basically are different colored balls that move at different speeds. Their color will also indicate how strong they are. And so what you're doing is you're fastening different types of turrets to hard points that are sort of predetermined on the map. But rather than just placing a turret on a hard point and calling it a day, you can actually build out these trees of platforms that have multiple turrets on them and then program the turrets so that, you know, turret number one will attack the strongest enemy in its range. Turret number two will attack the fastest enemy in its range.
Oh, so you get to logic gate them.
Yes.
Ooh, I like that.
And it is really, really good. It makes sense why they made it co-op, because it gets really complicated. Like the more you – I mean, there's just a ton of different options and turrets, and programming the stuff is really
really
intricate. So it's – anyway, definitely worth checking out. It's $5.
That's cool.
Totally. No, I like this idea.
If you're a tower defense guy.
Yeah. See, I'm sort of a tower defense guy, but I find that they sort of merged into one big mess of always having more or less the same thing. And then, you know, some of the ones that people like, so well, like Anomaly, where it reverses the deal.
Uh-huh.
Everyone seemed like they thought that was great. And I played, I was like, I don't know, didn't do that much for me.
This sort of made me remember why I liked traditional tower defense games in the first place. Because it is advanced.
Did you see that new one that Frozen Byte's doing that just released on Steam as well? I've only watched a video of it. The idea is that you're defending planets from Martian invaders or from interstellar invaders, and each of the towers are satellites or orbiting a planet, and so you're able to adjust the orbit, the tracking orbit of the of the towers that you're using to defend to position them such that they change the pathing that the enemies will take. So now you have control. Oh, wow. You have control over where the pathing will go, and based off each enemy type, then you have to adapt your orbits of your protection devices to make their pathing be such that you have an advantage. You know, did you gain the advantage with your defending towers?
Okay.
Which is kind of a neat twist.
I think I need to play this. You said Frozen by... Do you remember what it's called?
We'll look it up in the break. We will look it up in the break. It just hit Steam this past week. I literally got an email on it yesterday and watched the video. I was like, okay, that's pretty clever. I like that. That's a new gaming twist to it. Because there's only so many times you can drop towers and upgrade them and be like...
Absolutely.
Okay, I've done this.
But messing with pathing is cool.
Messing with pathing is cool. Logic gating is cool.
Yeah.
I think it's nice to see that some of these folks are really starting to say, okay, well, we got this idea. And now that people understand it, what can we do with it? What can we layer on top of that to make more mechanic to it than just, I'm going to throw 55,000 waves at you and you are going to survive somehow.
Right. And you said eight player co-op. I need to get some friends.
It sounds fun. It's definitely interesting.
Terrorhedron.
And there isn't really anything out there like it. I mean, I don't know if there are any other co-op tower defense games. So I can't really think of any.
No, no. You know, we talked a lot last week about handhelds as well, which we're going to pick up on the flip side here. I will say, though, that I played a couple of worlds in Super Mario 3D Land, and I'm on the team with you guys. It's a fantastically designed game that's really in step with the hardware. I'm not going to join the Billy Berghammer side of it validating the hardware because, look, you still have the fundamental problem with the 3DS that if you do not hold that device in just the right spot for the lenticular system to work, you lose the 3D. So, yes, the game is great and uses 3D very well in the context of its design. And that only reemphasizes for me how much of a struggle I have at times, like playing with this thing in my hands, where if I move it and I lose the 3D, then it messes the whole deal up. And that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are your feelings about shutting it off? I mean, I know that kind of defeats half the gimmick.
I would actually take you to task for calling it a gimmick, because I think that the incorporation of three-dimensional level design into Mario is as good as Galaxy was in Revolution on home console. They absolutely nailed doing a platformer in 3D space with me being able to understand where my character is in the world, use that character on platforms that had me do skill moves, and not feel like I was fighting to figure out where the hell I was in 3D space.
Well, the design may be good, but if the tech is still wonky like you're talking about, then it's kind of gimmicky, right? I mean, you know, like aid to – that's all I meant.
So you asked me about turning off – I mean, I don't think you could – I would – you can't play the game with a 3D off. You have to play with a 3D
on.
To play with a 3D on, because there's so much of it that is all about these really cool spatial environments that you're navigating. And they did a really cool job with, you know, like the whole 2D paradigm is flat. So you only had, you know, maybe one or two that you always thought about in terms of, okay, there's a high path, a mid path, and a low path. And maybe we go through a portal and go into like a whole little secret path. But you're always thinking left to right on screen,
right.
Or up to down. But, you know, it's that sort of thing. Here, they've really embraced this idea of anywhere freedom of I can go over here to the left and I can go up and I can go over here and go down. And I have all these different ways of accomplishing getting places. And they just did that. They built their levels in 3D space so well that, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the folks who were the level designers on this game, because they really had their heads around envisioning 3D spaces and then creating at the same time traditional platforming elements that were not following any rules that had been written before, because they opened up all this 3D world for them to play in, and yet still feel like you've been doing it since you had a Super Nintendo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
Hence the Galaxy, when Galaxy came out.
Exactly.
Around, that was the same.
You're on these cylinders, and you're on these globes, and everything's in crazy 3D space, and yet at the same time, you're like, I feel like I've been doing, like you picked up and played the first world, and you're like, I've been doing this for forever, but I've never done it before.
Right.
Which is crazy.
That is very cool.
How do you make someone feel like that? How do you make someone feel like, I know exactly what this is like, but I've never done it before.
They're a crazy team. I don't know how they do the things they do. And what you're describing sounds to me a little like Paper Mario. Did you ever play Paper Mario?
Yes, exactly. Sort of same vibe. Same immediate click vibe where you're like, whoa, this is freaking awesome.
Yeah.
I've never done it before, but I feel like I've done it forever, and it's awesome, and I want to do more of it.
It makes you feel smart, yeah.
Yeah, it really does. All right. Well, hopefully we'll make you feel smart. We got one more segment to go, folks, before we are done on this Friday the 13th. Stick around. We have a bunch of your comments and topics to discuss as we close out Weekend Confirmed.
It's the Scottish sniper captain that leads you through the mission.
Are we actually going to talk about any games you played this week? Because I'd like to play
Star Wars.
Did you join Loom in the Force?
Star Wars.
I did.
Do you hate yourself?
Hate yourself.
Choose between Sentinels and Leopardy.
Star Wars.
Which you going to choose?
Choose.
Jedi Knight.
Well, see, now that's not really the class.
Which you going to choose?
You don't know. Star Wars. Now you cool.
I'm a Sentinel. The dual wielding lightsaber guy.
Now you cool.
Then I'm going Sentinel.
Star Wars.
No one needs televisions.
Star Wars.
We're gonna stick with the blue, monochrome, interlaced, shitty asshole
televisions.
No one needs televisions.
And it looks like it's about a 5-year difference between technology.
No one needs televisions.
Star Wars.
Dude, have you seen Leia in that? It's like so compelling.
Star Wars.
They haven't. It's not for 1,000 years.
By the way, the show just like jumped up in intensity by
a factor of 1,000 years.
A thousand years. Jeff, your Star Wars rant last week resonated with very many folks on our forums. Jeff has a little complaint about the, you know, how nothing changes in Star Wars, and if anything, the tech might actually be cooler 1,000 years before A New Hope. And he's all about these continuity issues. Did you read his latest thing too? He like pointed to some YouTube critique of the first three movies that he says, like, if you watch it, you'll hate the first three movies even more. We need to get people to hate the first three movies more.
Well, no, I have a theory, because I just put myself through that again recently, because I was like, oh, I want to watch Star Wars again. I'm like, well, I've only seen the crappy prequels once. No.
What a man.
No,
I'll tell you, you're a hero.
I need a badge of honor or something.
And scary, they're coming in 3D.
Yeah.
Which I saw when we went to the movies over the weekend. There was a preview for Star Wars in 3D. And the 3D's not even any good.
Yeah.
It's pretty disappointing.
3D suckage.
On the other hand, BioWare has been enjoying great success with The Old Revolution. And if you've been, you know, one of the first complaints that I heard people level was, okay, I rushed through to the end, which, you know, what's with people rushing through to the end of MMOs? The whole thing is the experience. And I think BioWare is really into this idea that each character class is almost like a whole new game because there's that much lore to it. But they felt the pressure because the mentality we have around MMOs is that you get to the level cap, and that's part of the game. And then the second part of the game is once you get to the level cap, what do you get to do once you're there? So there's a new patch, a new update, or their first update coming, which is the Rise of the Rakghouls, mm-hmm. which will be out on Tuesday already. And it's going to introduce, among other things, a lot of new high-level group content, which should make people happier. So if you're playing Star Wars, hold on. If you've already gotten to level 50, or start a new character, for Christ's sakes. Jesus, don't get to the top and just get pissed. There's four characters and two classes for each one. Go have fun.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this thing's also got Rakghouls in it, right?
Space zombies.
Yeah.
I was surprised that they went space zombies.
Well, you know, Rakghouls were in...
We're in Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I know that it was established lore, but it's still space zombies.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, if you haven't watched the intro video yet, it's space zombies.
Okay, isn't rushing sort of like the equivalent of like forums posters saying like first?
Kind of. Kind of.
I'm trolling a little bit, but
no. But because if you're somebody who doesn't do that, you're like, good for you, buddy.
Yeah, that's really you how know? I feel. Like. Yeah, it seems like I got that out of you.
Cool story, bro.
You wanted enjoy the experience. What's the point of getting all the way to the end?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, so I played World of Warcraft right when it came out, and I was with friends, and we were very much on the train to 60. And we were on the train to 60, and I don't really know why we hopped on that train so hard, but once you get on it, it's really hard to get off of because you start getting that Pavlovian response syndrome going, right? It's like, I'm going to – and that's the whole, like, stay up till 3 a.m. thing. It feeds on that same sort of thing of one more turn of civilization because you know you're going to get the next piece. You're going to get the next piece, and then there's the next – you know, your skill tree is the tech tree, and you want to see that next skill, and you're building up. And you're like, man, I only need 5 more levels because in 5 more levels I'll have 6 more action points to put in my skill tree, and I'll be able to come over and get – and so you just can't get away from it, right? But then you get there, and in WoW, what was cool was then you had these great raids.
Yeah.
And the raids was where the game blossomed a lot because that was where you suddenly had these narrative pieces that tied into all the Azeroth lore and you were getting these cool stories and cool set pieces. And then it reminded me there was an MMO because the fifth or sixth time you play them, because you're trying to get the drop to pop off of whatever boss, suddenly it's not really nearly as interesting anymore. You don't really care about those people nearly so much. And I fell off the train. And, you know, the difference was that in WoW, it was really only the starting zones that were different. They were really different, right? Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. once you got past the starting zones, you were grinding up a character. It's just a matter of, like, are you going to be a caster? Are you going to be a healer? Are you going to tank? And you had all the prototypes. And I think that the idea behind Star Wars, and I'm hopeful that they're really achieving, that I'm really interested to see, is each of those character classes having a really, really thought through, full experience story of its own that's unique. So,
yeah, it's like a single player RPG.
In multiple pieces that you can put together and play with other people
and play
online
alongside your friends. Yeah.
That's
in a setting you love.
In a setting you love. Well, or don't love, depending on.
Well, you're not there if you don't love it.
I don't know, man. People drag themselves back to Star Wars just to tell me how much they hate them. I kind of.
No, those.
Love hate is love.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, is all. Yeah. Anybody ever been in a relationship?
Yeah.
I'm just saying, you know, I rest my case.
There is, I mean, there's a big thing about investment in our games that, I mean, that really, okay, I'm going to hold off this handheld thing because this really ties in very well to this whole idea of something we were talking about last week with this gamer shame idea. And, you know, to bring this back, what Jeff was talking about was that, Jeff Cannata in this case, that he loves Star Wars, but he also has this sense of gamer guilt was what he called it. But, you know, like, you're like, I should be doing something else but yet he's loving and enjoying the game, which is funny because he does love loving things. So I don't understand why he wouldn't be, you know, completely at peace with that. But that really struck a chord with a number of people. And, you know, we referenced Jane McGonigal's book, which I went back and looked up some information on. And I'm actually very interested in. I need to go read this now because it sounds like it's fascinating. It's called Reality is Broken: Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. And basically what she found out of this was that there's a positive effect to gaming seen in those who play games up to 21 hours per week. And even then, you know, beyond that 21 to 28 hours, they still have very positive effects. So, Jeff, no matter how much you're playing, it's highly unlikely that, you know, and I know Jeff's an active guy. He's got an acting career. He does TRS. He's got all kinds of things going on. I don't think that he's playing more than 20 hours a week. I bet he's lucky if he's playing 10 or 12 hours a week. And yet at the same time, that thing of this gamer guilt thing kicks in. So interestingly, we had a couple of sides to this. Poster I hadn't read before, who had a bunch of great comments this week, was at an Atari 165, who said this: with the obvious exception of those really important things like taking care of one's family accomplishments in a game. Let me read that with the right emphasis. With the obvious exception of those really important things like taking care of one's family, accomplishments in a game are no less meaningful than most accomplishments in real life. Almost everything you accomplish in real life will have no more effect on the world 100 years from now than what you accomplish in Star Wars The Old Republic. I enjoy my real life work because it's fun, not because it is real. I enjoy games for the same reason. In my book, the only thing that trumps games in importance is family and friends. That's a really interesting, if extreme, point of view.
Existentialist, I would say. Yeah, definitely. It's scary to think that way, because then it's sort of, what are you doing with your time anyway? Like, are you going to make any impact at all? Are you going to make anybody's life better at all?
Yeah.
If you want to just accept that 100 years from now, maybe it won't mean anything, then that's okay. But what about a year from now, or 6 months from now, or 20 months? Mm-hmm. Like, 100 years is a great number, because eventually everything's going to fall off the planet. And if all you're living for is just to enjoy yourself, then maybe that's... Then gamer guilt shouldn't mean anything.
Well, my example is 5 years ago, I realized that I either had to make video gaming part of how I made a living or really not do it as much anymore. And that's when I, you know, started writing for Shaq News and got involved with Gamefly and stuff. I mean, it was – but for me, that question's a little bit different because I justify it in different ways. I think everybody that consumes a lot of media – thinks about that, though. The way I look at it is I lump TV, gaming, anytime I'm staring at a screen, all into one chunk of time. And as long as I'm not, you know, spending more than I would any other day, as long as I'm staying within the parameters of what I think is acceptable, I don't worry about it. But I think everybody kind of manages that differently. If I had a non-gaming related job, I don't know if I could, you know, I'd be as comfortable with my lifestyle as I am.
Because what you're saying is you can sort of tie your hobby into your income.
Yeah, so I'm like, well, I'm, you know.
Why is that, though? Why don't we take a step back a little bit from the precipice of this, like, really extreme existential idea and question, why is it that we would discount the value of those things that we accomplish? And I will use quotes on accomplish in games because they are giving us a valuable response. They're giving us that rich part of entertainment and enjoyment and mental stimulation that we wanted, no differently than, I mean, does that mean that attending a movie or a play or the orchestra is not an accomplishment? Does that belittle that if I chose to go do that? Does that mean that is there something inherently better about me deciding to do my laundry tonight?
Well, non-gamers are constantly telling gamers in society that what they do is, you know, a waste of time or whatever. So you have that underpinning. Like you have a whole
maybe other, they're jealous.
Like people that don't get it, like, you know.
Maybe they're jealous.
It's our fault for being self-conscious. If we don't think that they're making any sense, we should just ignore them. They're just people making noises. You know, there are a lot of people who criticize us for things that we don't happen to share their perspective on.
Yeah, I agree with you.
What I really like about Jane is I think the reason she brings up this whole thing is because she's talking about how games give us these tangible rewards that we talked about earlier. It's like, oh, I'm level 6 now. That's better than level 5. And in real world, we don't get those numbers so often. We might get a promotion every 2 years or 5 years or whatever it is, but we don't see those jumps in sort of behavior, like rewarding. So she's saying, can we apply these systems to something to make the world a better place or to encourage people to work out, to feed the homeless, to like combat poverty? She's sort of saying, can we take these game systems and use those tangible rewards to make people feel encouraged to do something that's not just playing games?
And I get that. I mean, I can, you know, I'm a case example of that having worked with EA Sports Active. I started, you know, like when I was old, but not as old as I am now, and wasn't really exercising a lot. I saw EA Sports Active. I was like, you know, that's really interesting, and I could do that. And I started doing it because I was like, you know, obviously if it's a video game, it can't be too threatening, right? But then it turns out that EA Sports Active actually was pretty athletic in its approach and pretty disciplined, and ultimately wound up the fact where I haven't used EA Sports Active in like 2-3 years, but I work out 4 or 5 times a week now, and it's just become part of something I do. So it did sort of train me that. But that's cool, and I get how that system worked. And you told this neat story about – well, you should tell the story about Diablo because that's pretty cool.
So Diablo 2 is sort of my really first RPG, and it taught me how to do all these basic RPG things. Like, and I later learned that it was min-maxing. It was sort of spending time to get the maximum reward in the game. And I started applying these lessons that I was learning about time management and being efficient to the rest of my life until it got to the point where I feel that Diablo 2 really taught me to stop playing Diablo 2. And it said, it sort of the lessons that it taught me said I was wasting my time. And eventually I got to the point where I was like, I really still wanted to play. So I started botting Diablo 2 to sort of save that sort of gameplay experience. And I started selling the items to sort of supplement some income with it, so that it was sort of enriching my life. And eventually I just sort of like kicked the habit because it was just taking too much time out of my life and I wasn't getting enough return out of it.
And yet you still play games and you still enjoy games. So maybe you just sort of fallen into a rut there. Maybe it broke you out of a rut in that particular one.
It changed the way that I played games. And I said I will only play multiplayer games or games where I feel like I'm actually learning something.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And because I work in games, I can use that learning something for pretty much anything. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I do actually at some points in time think, wow, am I broken or am I crazy? Because I do internalize the rewards that I get out of playing games a lot of times. And I find them valuable. I don't argue that. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a feeling of, well, you know, they're going to have the things I'm going to do in the world, in the real world, aren't going to have any impact on 100 years. I don't think of it in that terms. I just think of it in terms of, you know, the reward response and enjoyment that I get out of playing a game is a valuable reward in and of itself. And I enjoy those things so very much. But I also get really wrapped up in it. And I have this problem a lot. And it actually drives Ariel nuts because, for instance, the other night I'm playing Madden. And I've gotten into this league where we have an ongoing, and I've talked about this before, four-string leagues, Madden League, where we play, you know, over and over. We build up our teams. It becomes almost RPG-like where you manage your team, build up your players, and then you play games. And it's late in the fourth quarter, and I'm feverishly holding on to a lead, and I make a mistake. You know, I look out in the flat, and if you don't know football, it's not going to mean a lot. But just sort of take it that I made a mistake and threw a ball that was intercepted and run back for a touchdown, and that was the end of the game, and that was my losing move. And I knew right when I threw the ball, I was like, fuck! I knew it right as soon as I punched the button that I had screwed up and that I was going to get punished for it. And I got punished for it. Yet at the same time, it made me mad enough that I went, damn it! And she's like, what on earth is going on with you? How are you so wrapped up in this game? And I had never, you know, no one's ever sat there and like really paid attention. I thought about it.
And Garnet was like, shut up! I'm mad!
I don't know why I'm so wrapped up in it. I don't know how I get so engaged in it. Yet, I mean, it was getting that strong a response. Ken's smiling. Now, is that a good thing, Ken?
Again, a lot of this feels very abstract to me. And I'm thinking back to when I used to be a teacher, and I'm not looking at the positive effects that McGonagall's thinking about. I'm mostly working from the negative effects, like abusive behavior, which when I was a high school teacher, I was taught to look for those elements in an alcohol substance abuse way. And then I learned a lot about substance abuse. And I think it's reasonable to think of reading and television watching, much less games thing, as a form of substance abuse. So
sure.
Mostly what I think you need to be in your life is alert to messages from people you care about that there might be something amiss. And you shouldn't ask whether those are abstractly correct or not, or, you know, try to validate them one way or the other. They say, you know, good time just to, you know, think about what I'm doing and see how it's going. So what it really comes down to is, do you listen to your friends and to the people you care about? And I don't care what they want to talk about. You eating too much garbage food? You listen to them or not? And if you're defensive about it, that's going to be a problem. And I think it's just human nature, and learn how to mediate that. I don't think you get a lot of use in getting too deep into it in the abstract this way.
We over-navel-gazed it.
Maybe. I'm curious, like, if you feel guilty for getting angry at yourself.
No, actually, I felt stupid.
Really?
Yeah, because I do actually, I mean, if I didn't, I felt confused, maybe more than, I felt confused, because I was like, you know, I appreciate that I was into the game and like was in the moment, like that it had me caught up enough that I was into it and feeling those like raw emotions of like, I'm into it, I want to win this, I've got, oh shit, I screwed it up because I was engaged in it. But at the same time, I think, well, it is a game and I'm just having fun with it, and you know, it really isn't the end of the world or anything. It's not, you know,
it happens with spectator sports all the time.
Yeah,
people riot.
Well, and then I think, well, that's kind of nuts, too.
I guess so.
So,
but it's fun to get excited about that.
I don't think.
Yeah.
And when you ask a question, if you always know the answer the moment you ask the question, that's not really a very interesting question. I'm thinking the process of going through this and saying,
yeah,
the time of processing it, you may be uncomfortable with it. You are stupid. You're supposed to be uncomfortable when you don't know the answer to the question. It's just simple. You should feel that way when you don't know. And that's one of the delights of it. And at some point, you'll either stop being uncomfortable and stop thinking about it, or if you're still thinking about it, maybe it's time for action. You know, you go from that action loop to the – from thinking loop to the action loop. It again, sounds so common sense to me that it worries me a little bit that we take the abstract discussion about it too seriously, because then people can get excited about abstractions and maybe not all that important. How you feel and, you know, making questions and not being sure and feeling comfortable about not being sure, and then waiting until it goes away, or like if a common cold, oh, I got a question, have I got a cold? You wait, you know, or do something.
Let me try and hit this from another angle, because what you're saying is that there are people who I'm identifying that there's people that, including myself, that feel gamer guilt very personally, and we're trying to talk about it on a very abstract, is there one sort of size fits all answer,
right,
for
precisely
everybody?
That's what I'm worried about, that one, yeah. In other words, is there any truth that we're looking for here? And the only truth I'm thinking we're looking for is we want to be humans and not suck at it. And then we're pretty familiar. The patterns of this aren't not peculiar to games. They're, you know, peculiar to almost everything we do as mammals. Big, charming mammals that eat a lot.
And we'd like to be validated that our pursuits are reasonable and good.
Now you're beginning to get into area. You know, if yes, we have questions about our validations. And if we start talking about that in the abstract, I'm yelling at us for being too self-conscious. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to have faith in what you're doing.
Yeah.
You may be getting difficult feedback from people you care a lot about. And then, you know, that's a strain. But that's whether you want to become a
a welder in a family that only has people that went to Princeton or not. I mean, you're always going to get those kind of problems. So gaming, well, just another of the many things that people may not be sure that you ought to be doing. And you better, you should go through the questioning period. Yeah, say, I'm not sure. And then you should say, okay, I know what I should be doing. I know when I go to action. Now it's time for action.
I'd have made a hell of a welder, I think. I'm going to be a hell of a welder.
I like burning things.
I like burning things, too.
But that's probably not a reason to get involved in using
– just really cool place up in the Bay called the Crucible. You're checked out like they do like this – oh, you should check it out. Check out the Crucible. They do like a really cool art show in twice a year, which is all like this burning stuff and all these giant metallic sculptures and stuff.
Yeah.
You got to check it out. It's a really cool place.
I love the whole idea.
Men
of, like,
are currently writing feverishly on their paper now just and, in case they would.
And they also give classes. They have like classes. They have like a foundry. You can like, do all these cool –
in burning things? Yeah. Okay. I rest my case.
Yeah.
All right.
QED.
So we'll wrap things up. We will wrap them up with the whole portable games thing. MH Silver sort of like draws this whole thing to a close for me by saying that for the difference between games and gaming behavior on iOS versus dedicated handhelds, for you guys contextually, we've had this big running thing about where iOS games are cannibalizing handhelds and whether or not Vita, however cool it is or is not, couldn't compete, is this. iOS is for people who want to kill time with games. Dedicated handhelds are for people who make time for games. And that the only problem that sets up for him is that with dedicated handhelds approaching the experience of hand consoles, that he'd rather make time to play games on a big screen as long as you're making time to play games. But I think that's that actually, to me, sort of puts the period in the whole end of this thing, is that they're separate. And then people were complaining that, you know, I'm not giving iOS games enough credit and that you can play big meaty experiences on there. And I don't debate that. I played those. But I find those to not be the really get me, grab me, want to play on my iPad and iPhone games. Those are games I think, well, I would have a better time playing this on a dedicated handheld. And vice versa. Yeah, PSP, Vita, they're both going to have minis and that sort of those sort of experiences. But I'm going to probably think, I'd rather just pull out my phone and do this, you know? There's a reason that Jetpack Joyride is so fun. It's because you pull out your phone, you play for a couple of minutes, it's goofy, you throw it away. And it is totally a time killer. Yeah, to me.
I'm going to take a very tiny subset of exceptions to that. For example, a game that I've been playing lately is King of Dragon Pass, which was once a PC game and which is not practical now to release as a PC game because the code is just way too hard to do. But it's not hard to do on an iOS thing. And it's a brilliant it's like a one-of-its-kind role-playing a tribe game, only done with a quality of writing that you just never see any other place. So there will be a tiny subset of places, I think, where you can take another game from another format and put it back into the currency and in a better format, an accessible format. And then you should actually play it on the iOS because it can't be ported to those other things practically. But that again, other than that, I think you got a Loctite.
All right. So as usual, we have wound up with way more content than we had to squeeze into this entire show. But we still have one parting shot, and that would be finishing moves.
Finishing moves.
Jeff Mattis, you can start her off.
All right. Well, we missed covering these earlier, so I just wanted to note that the IGF finalists have been announced for this year. And I just want to go over the Seamus McNally Grand Prize nominees. Go and check out the entire list of games on Shaq News. There's a lot of really good stuff, some of which is already playable. I'd highly recommend coming through it. But without further ado, the Seamus McNally Grand Prize nominees are Dear Esther, which is like a first-person adventure game. It was based on a Half-Life 2 mod. Valve basically gave it their support and blessing to make a retail release. It's narrative-driven, very cool. There's a lot of info online. Fez is the second nominee. That's by Polytron. I'm sure if you've been paying any attention to the indie scene for the past 3 years, you've probably heard something about Fez. It's supposed to be coming out this year. Really cool exploration-based platformer. Next nominee is Frozen Synapse, which was a really, really good top-down strategy game that came out this year. It's sort of like the planning stages of the old Rainbow Six games where you'd basically have to intuit what your enemies or what the opponents were going to do as you plotted out the moves and...
Okay, I got to interrupt. That game is super badass.
Yeah,
I love that game.
It's really good. It'll bake your noodle, but it's really good. The last two is Johann Sebastian Joust, which is – I got to play that at IndieCade this year, and it is played with PlayStation Move controllers. There's no, you know, screen or anything like that, and it's motion-based. So you're jousting with each other and trying to disturb the other person's Move controller without disturbing yours. And so, you know, they're motion-sensitive, so when one gets jostled, it's like a really sort of neat game of tag, sort of. Anyway, really cool. And the last nominee is Spelunky, which is a platformer roguelike that is pretty awesome if you haven't checked it out.
Nice.
So that was kind of a long finishing move, but there you go.
Well done. I'm going to grab the next one so we can let the two guests from Big Huge finish us up today. Thanks very much for joining us, guys. We'll have a little close after you guys finish. I'm going to do real quickly a quick wrap-up on Xbox's bragging from CES. By the way, it's Microsoft's final pre-night, pre-CES keynote. You know, it's kind of a weird changing of the guard. And you know, gaming has really gone away from CES because we've established our own space, as we talked about earlier. And it seems like even the tech market is now getting so big it's going to splinter. Microsoft probably looking at Apple and other outlets saying, why are we sharing a stage at CES when we can have our own stage wherever we want to, whenever we want to? So changing of the guard and passing there. They've got some great numbers they bragged about. They've got 66 million 360s now all over the world. They have 40 million members logging into live. That's pretty good when you've got, you know, two-thirds of the people who have your console hooking it up online. Now, they didn't say golds, but they just mean that they're getting online. But two-thirds getting online is pretty big. They're up to 18 million Kinects now. And then they've got some interesting stuff happening with their video app world. And the one that's most intriguing to me is this new app that's coming from Fox, where they're going to suck in the Fox News Channel, which is crazy to me in the first place because I don't think of the average video game consumer as a neoconservative, but maybe, I mean, I'm not trying to stereotype, but I mean, it's just,
yeah.
Fox has a certain reputation. It seems to get thrown around a lot and, you know, whatever. Whatever your political leanings are, I'm sure that you play games. I dug myself a grave there.
Nightmare. That's why I didn't say anything.
Nightmare. But what I'm really interested to see is how they're going to handle this interaction with shows as they're happening through the app. That could be nuts. That could be absolutely nuts, especially as lightning rod as Fox News could get. I mean, that could be all over the place.
Dude, I want the game show that uses that tech, you know, so I can play at home.
We had some of that. And then last but not least, Kinect is going to be hitting Windows boxes on February the 1st. But it sounds, I think there's been a little confusion here. It sounds very much like this is targeted at, you know, institutional use because they're really partnering up with organizations like American Express and Toyota and United Health Group to revolutionize education, healthcare, manufacturing, science, and more. So I think that they're obviously laying the groundwork for Kinect grew out of stuff you saw at the end of old Gates CES presentations years ago, mm-hmm. where they were talking about their human interaction design stuff. That was always big stuff they were big on. Kinect grew out of that, and now they're going to complete the circle with within the next year or two as Kinect becomes a manner of interacting with PCs and all the things that we do in Windows 8. And I don't think it's a big surprise. And so they're working with corporate level partners to start off and say, what can you guys do with this? So interesting, mm-hmm. interesting time for computers and games and Microsoft, and they sold a bunch of Xboxes. Congratulations, guys. All right, who goes first? Jay, you going first?
Yeah, I'll go first.
Do it!
So I'll just give you a little backstory. The combat pit, the combat team at Big Huge Games, we ran this weekly combat challenge throughout the development of Reckoning, but sort of towards the end, we had to start crunching, and we were unable to continue doing it, so we started with push-ups or Mario speedruns and all sorts of things. And since it's been down for so long, it's been really hard to start back up since the team grew to 15 people or so. But I'm going to call out the combat team and say February 7th, when Reckoning ships, we are going to begin with a wall sit competition. And that's it.
A wall sit competition.
Yeah, it's sitting against the wall with there is a chair there, but you're not allowed to.
So that's like bridges, too.
Yeah.
Oh, man. They look so simple. You see someone doing it, and you're like,
but then they burn, and then your legs. It's a mental game. It's really tough.
Cool. Can you get to bring her home?
Well, in my mission to bring important things to the people, and I've come out to California from the East Coast, I thought you should know, since I now know about these things, there is a food called the Bacon Explosion. And I'm told that it takes about 4 hours to make, but I'm sure that it's good for all of you. And then I'd like to share with you a website which is connected to a service which I think all of us need. It's called Psycho Donuts, psycho-donuts, D-O-N-U-T-S.com. And that's up, I think, in the San Francisco area. In other words, it's North California. It has some deeply, deeply, deeply troubled sculptural uses of donuts. And I'm just saying, you better get out there and get them now.
That's pretty awesome.
That was awesome.
I'm hungry for bacon.
Although he didn't make me suddenly think of Boomerang Pete's. All right, folks, there you go. And another website you should definitely check out would be ReckoningTheGame.com, of course. And actually, we were talking about this during the break. You probably actually should go to the Facebook page for Reckoning the Game because they're more actively updating information on the game. So along with, when the demo comes out, it'd be a good place to talk about it. And have conversations there. That's probably where you're going to get the latest and greatest on what's coming up with Reckoning the Game.
Yep, at least one trickle of news per day, definitely.
I think so. One trickle of news per day.
Yeah, it's a slow drip.
Joe, you guys at all social media guys at all? Twitter, that kind of stuff? Anyone want to follow you? Do you want anyone to follow you?
I am Bazooie on Twitter, B-A-Z-O-O-I-E.
I can't remember what my Twitter thing is. I think it's Rev Love Butter or Reverend Love Butter.
It's Rev Love Butter.
It's Rev Love Butter. Yeah. Reverend Love Butter is the name that I go under for a lot of online murdering games. So I'm just
online murdering games.
Yeah.
I like it. All right, folks, that's a big show. Thanks very much for joining us. Next week, Carlos was going to be here, but he is tied up in San Francisco. So I don't know what we're going to do. We'll do some sort of show. We'll figure it out.
We'll do a thing.
They'll be talking. Andrea Renee is going to be here. Maybe we'll bring Ariel back again. We can have like the girls showdown again or something. Be fun. We'll have a good time. And then coming up after that, Jeff will be back once we get that worked out. We've got David Jaffe lined up. It's like a whole smorgasbord of 2012 fantastic, awesome things for you to tell us that we don't know what we're talking about over. That's what you usually do, right? All right, that's it, folks. That's your Weekend Confirmed. Big, big thanks to everyone at Electronic Arts. Also, thank you who helped these guys come out here and be part of the show today. Ken, thanks very much. Joe, thanks a ton.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Great thanks, successes.
Jeff. Thanks, Garnet.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
All right.
Way too much fun.
Ecstatic.
Wet all over now.
next time on The Delicious Dish.
Not sanitary anymore.
All right.
Peach Woody.
Until next week, we are Ghost.
The same line too. You get my voice heard over these airwaves. All I gotta do is get me some airplay. Show you that I love you, show you that I care, show you that I listen, show you that I'm here. I sold you all of that, I sold you everything. I gave my all to y'all, following those are 3 rings. You know more about me, anyone will ever know. In my love for you, I'll never let it go.
Everything I ever wanted, everything I ever needed, but I'm still struggling, still competing for your love, your heart. And you,
always be together, never be apart. Even from the early start, I'll do anything for you.
Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.